Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Political Party. This episode features Lewis Goodall from The News Agents, formerly of Newsnight, Sky News, published author, all-round mega talent, and only 34 years old. We talk about his life, his upbringing, the effect it had on him, his university experience, his politics. He's just such a fantastic person to talk to. Real gift of chat. And this is a real treat. Now, this is the first episode I put out for a while. It's the first one since the Kate Forbes episode in August. And a few people have got in touch asking why. Obviously, the show is still alive, which is great. But I've had a bit of a health issue. So if you came to see me at the Edinburgh Festival, you know I was suffering with terrible sciatica in August. And I obviously went to the doctors and got it sorted. Got some amazing painkillers, which made those Edinburgh shows even more wonderful than they usually are. But I had an MRI. And I've got a tumour on the spine, so I'm going to have it removed. So I'm having surgery very soon, and it will be removed. And then I think the recovery may take a bit. So I'm recording episodes at the moment before I go into hospital, so that there's still stuff on the feed. But I may repeat some old episodes and curate a little series of some of my favourite moments and things like that, so that you've got something to listen to. And I hate not doing the show. It's been the worst things about the last few weeks has been not being able to interview people. And obviously it just means that the live shows, the ones with Jason Williamson from the Sleaford Mods with Dan Jarvis, and then the Harriet Harman and Rory Stewart shows will all be rescheduled. But that will probably be in a few months' time. And I'll just keep you updated on what's going on a little bit. Not in too much detail, obviously. But I obviously just need to get that sorted. So hopefully surgery will solve that problem, I'll recover, and then I'll be back doing live shows, including my tour next year and everything else. But for the time being, I'll just record a few of these remote ones, and I'll be back. So this was recorded with Lewis Goodall on Sunday, just at the start of the Labour Party conference. And Lewis's book, which you have to read, and I will put a link to it, Left for Dead, the Death and Strange Rebirth of the Labour Party, just such a timely piece. And it was just great, basically, about the Labour Party dying. And then we talk about this in the interview about the Corbyn effect. And you can just sense with Lewis that whether or not that's the Labour that he identifies with, there was something fascinating about it and its result of the 2017 election and what that meant about where the country was and things like that. So this is a great discussion about all sorts of things, including how some political broadcasters don't seem to understand politics. And obviously we don't name names, but it's just interesting. The whole thing is great. He's a phenomenal person to spend time with. So I will now shut up and leave you in the wonderful hands of such a gifted broadcaster, Lewis Goodall. Lewis, I finally got round to this. I've wanted to have you on the podcast for years for a number of reasons, not just your wonderful work on Sky News and Newsnight, but your phenomenal book, Left for Dead, The Death and Strange Rebirth of the Labour Party. You have a fascinating history.
I think, Matt, you are its biggest proponent. I think you're a bigger proponent for it than me. You mention it every time. It's almost like a vintage item now. That's the problem when you write about contemporary politics. It's just such a mistake. I'm never doing that again.
It was a great book. It was perfect. It was a fantastic book. But one thing, and I remember thinking this, reading it, and it was a bit like I don't know if you ever saw the James Graham play Labour of Love.
You know what? I didn't. That was the one I didn't see. It was really annoying. I really wanted to see that one. I haven't seen that one. I haven't seen Dear England either, actually. But yeah. But I read about his Labour one. It sounded great.
Well, it reminded me of your book, because I read your book, obviously, with my politics in mind, and thought, oh, I think Lewis is on the same page as me. And I got that from James Graham's play. But then I thought, actually, if I was to the left of me, if I was a Corbynista, could I have read your book and conceivably felt there was something in it for me? And I
I then thought, where do you stand? You know, where were you as a Labour activist? Were you a socialist? Were you ever a communist, or were you a Blairite, or are you somewhere in between those stools?
When I was a kid, I mean, to be honest, I was probably a bit like, I mean, you're a bit older than me, but I was probably a bit like you from what I understand about your politics, Matt, which is that I was just like, I was the biggest Blair fanboy, right? I mean, it was like, you got to remember, like, this was like 2000. This wasn't like in the mid 90s when it was cool. This was like 2003 and 2004, right? This was like sort of proper dog days, sort of post-Iraq. And I was going along, and it makes me laugh because, you know, like the Guidos of this world and all that lot, you know, make such a big deal of this about being a Labour activist and this big, you know, sometimes I read some of this stuff and it's like I was sort of like in the shadow cabinet or something. My sort of grand ascension within the Labour Party was like youth officer of Birmingham Northfield CLP. And I have to say that in 2003-04, that was not a particularly competitive position, right? It was like me, the local MP, and like this old guy called Stan, who used to turn up to the CLP meeting sort of week after week. But I was just like, I don't know, I was just sort of so bitten so early by the kind of love of politics. And my family were always, you know, Labour, although in a very kind of small P political way, like they would never turn to meetings or anything. They were just those classic congenital kind of Labour voters because they're for us and the Tories aren't kind of thing. And I think I was just sort of this big Blair. I was just sort of captivated by him. My mom was captivated by him as well. And she still is. She used to fancy him terribly. She used to always just say, oh, he's so gorgeous, isn't he? He's so gorgeous. He's got a great body, hasn't he? My mom will still say that to this day. So
he has, though. He's in good shape.
He's in good shape. And now my wife works for him. So, you know, somehow he's sort of
taking over your life.
Orbiting my life. I know. But I hope she doesn't feel the same way as my mother did. But anyway, I was just sort of very, very sort of, I just always just felt sort of deeply Labour as a kid, right? And then I went to university and I think I sort of slightly soured on him and all this sort of thing. I mean, and I went into journalism. I think the truth is, and then later, when Corbyn came along, sort of to answer your questions, I was, you know, like you, I think many people who were sort of, you know, instinctively on the sort of left, centre-left, I felt very sceptical of him, not because of him, partly because of him personally as a character, because I'd sort of met him a few times, but also because I just sort of felt, I remember when I was a producer at Newsnight having a kind of quite a big argument, kind of quite improper, really, with James Schneider, who was then just still an outrider of his. And I kind of like had a go at him. And this is when Corbyn was still running. I kind of basically accused him of saying, you don't understand working class people. And you are going to destroy this, you know, this thing. And all because you just want to feel better about yourself. And it's totally improper, really, because I was a producer and I shouldn't have been saying things like that. And he was quite good about it. We had a quite a spirited argument. And I felt like that for a long time. And then I think in 2017, in the general election, when that happened, and you might disagree with this, and I know others do as well, I have to say something in me just suddenly thought, wow, this is really interesting. And I think the reason why the sort of, and this is when I was at Newsnight and at Sky, I think the reason why a lot of the kind of the Corbynista part of the party and the people around him, including Schneider, always kind of like didn't mind me and sort of didn't mind giving interviews to me and things like that is because I think they sort of knew that I wasn't kind of sort of one of them as such, but that I was sort of interested in what they were creating and what they were doing. And I was very interested in this movement. Suddenly, and I do think that I'm amazed at this sometimes, and this it speaks to the factionalism of the Labour Party and of British politics overall. They do have a point when they say, and that in 2017, 40% of this country voted for Jeremy Corbyn, right? Like, and I would never have thought that was possible. I just never would have thought that was possible. And I know people can talk about Theresa May and that campaign and whatever, but I think if anything, the last few years has taught me, and this is one of the reasons I like being a political journalist, is that the kind of smorgasbord of options, the parameters of options within British politics is so much wider than many of the kind of greybeards, the people who talk about iron laws of politics would tell us, because it is both possible, because both these things are true, that Jeremy Corbyn got 40% of the vote in 2017 and Boris Johnson got 44% in 2019. And so there are no iron laws. And I was very intrigued by what sort of he was creating and the movement they were creating. So there's a very long way of saying basically that I was sort of kind of Corbyn agnostic or ambivalent, if you like.
So then how, because it is tricky for people who then go into journalism, obviously Nick Robinson has sort of faced this as well. Having been a Labour activist and then you find yourself at Sky and the BBC, was that ever an issue for you? Was that ever an issue for your bosses?
It's never been an issue for my bosses. Well, some of the BBC bosses, not really, I thought you have to divide it, right? I mean, there has never been an issue from any boss or for me personally in terms of my work and how I approach journalism and so on. And I think actually, if anyone looked at any of the record, they would sort of see that. I mean, in all sorts of ways, and I could point to all sorts of things. There's never ever been any kind of impartiality complaint or anything that was ever upheld. No one's ever able to point to something. The issue always has come because there are certain people with an agenda who wanted to kind of create noise, right? And there's always, particularly at the BBC, less so at Sky, although it happened at Sky as well. But at the BBC, there's always like, there's always someone on the naughty step. There's always someone that is pointed to as like the person who the Mail or the Express or Guido, whoever it is, are going to point at and say, this is the guy who represents everything that's wrong with the BBC. And that person moves. There's always someone. And for a while, it was me. And it was never that they could point to anything in particular, because as I say, nothing was upheld, but they would just create a kind of noise and aura. And some bosses don't care about that. The BBC is very sensitive to that because all they see is like headline about someone and they don't really care what the content is. They just care that the headline is there. So it's never an issue for me. And you know, my view about this has always been this, like, I think that political, I mean, look, I will make no, I've never made any secret of the fact I am political. I'm a political person. Like, I've thought about politics like every day since, you know, I was like 10 or 11 or something. Like, you know, I don't quite know what I would be if politics was just sort of removed from my life. I just say it would just be this empty mass, right? But I think that makes for stronger political journalists, not weaker ones. And I was actually talking to a cabinet minister at the Tory party conference last week, and who I hadn't seen quite a while. And he just said to me, oh, how are you doing? How are you doing? I said, oh, I'm loving your work on the podcast. I said, oh, that's very nice. And he said, yeah, I always meant to say to you, I always felt like during the sort of height of the Boris years that you got a bit of a raw deal. And I said, oh, really? Why'd you say that? He said, well, I mean, like, it's always clear that you're political. But what I've always felt is that we know you're political and you're straight and you're, that sort of helps you understand us. And that's what I've always sort of felt. I've always felt that if you are a political person yourself, it doesn't matter if you're on the left or the right, or you're looking at someone, you can kind of understand how politicians think, as opposed to sometimes when you get, well, I would say non-political journalists, which I think is a weird thing. And they often just say things like, end up saying quite bland things and almost be like, oh, well, God, they're all a bit weird politicians, aren't they? It's like, no, that's not our job. Our job is to understand them and then explain to the public. And so I think that being political helps you. And I would say in that sense, yeah, I would say, kind of obvious, I suppose, in my background, I would be on the center left in the same way that I think, and I wouldn't seek to compare myself to him in other ways, but, you know, someone like Andrew Neil, for example, who's clearly on the center right, no one would, I think, doubt that, but he's excellent at what he does and always has been. So I think that's, there's a long history of that, and I've always been comfortable with it, but there are some people who, you know, try and use it.
And why for you then, if you, I mean, obviously you can, you're only 34, you've got a long life ahead, there's a whole load of other options open to you, but why for now do you think you've majored on political journalism reporting rather than seeking elected office or a strategy role with the Labour Party?
It sounds really like banal and trite, but I love the news. Someone said to me in journalism once, right, like, if you don't love the news and you might as well just go away, which is absolutely true. And to be honest, it drives my wife mad and it drives me mad in some way. Almost like, doesn't matter what the news story is, I kind of want to go. Like right now, I would love to go to Israel. I just absolutely love to go, just because, like, that's where it's at. I'm a bit annoyed. I'm at the Labour Party conference where the sort of story isn't at, really. Even though this is kind of like, in some ways, kind of my absolute milieu, like in lots of ways, and, you know, but it doesn't really matter. So there's something about, and particularly in broadcast news, I don't think I could have worked for papers sort of permanently, but particularly in broadcast news, there's something about the kind of synthesis of like the sort of the momentum of the story where it is and being able to see it and always being able to be there, plus the kind of synthesis with that and the sort of magic of broadcasting itself, which I love, particularly TV, but all of it. It's just kind of very, it's kind of electric to me. Like, I love it. I just absolutely love it. So, you know, I mean, who knows what the future would hold, but I can't imagine. I just sort of love it too much. And I love that. I love other journalists. I love the craft of it. And maybe it's because I've always done it, but I've never, ever once been bored of it. I think that, and particularly, you know, there's another thing, Matt, which I've thought about a lot, and I don't actually think it's a good thing, but I think one of the things that struck me most about the last sort of 5 years or so is like, and this was always there a bit, but the synthesis between news and media, between politics and media is now so great. And again, I don't necessarily think it's a good thing, but it's almost like it is so hard to know now where politics ends and the media begins. And so often the media itself too much so is the story and is where the arena where basically the whole of the kind of the kind of the actual craft of politics and the kind of the narrative and flow of politics goes, that I think that in a way you never quite feel, and again, I say it's not necessarily a good thing, but you kind of feel both in politics and not in politics in that weird sort of way, because the fusion is now so great. Don't think it's a good thing, but it is what it is.
But that's it, isn't it? I mean, you get involved in politics because you have a view of the way the world should be, often motivated by a sense that things are wrong and that things need to change. And along the way, there are elements of the discourse and the arena that you find exciting and entertaining, the ability to report on it, to go to places where the story is, to be the person that explains it to people. But also, you kind of got into politics because you wanted to change things. And isn't there, in a way, a higher calling is not the right way to put it, but not just to report on the story, but to actually be the person shaping it, because you are changing the world yourself and not being the person talking about the person changing it.
There's the great Teddy Roosevelt quote, which I love, where he talks about the arena and he talks about the idea that politics is the arena, and that, you know, the people can sort of criticize and be on the sidelines as much as they like, but they will never know, even on the sort of worst day, I'm paraphrasing it massively, but even on the worst day, they will never quite know the kind of thrill of the arena itself. And I completely get that. And I'm of course. I think anyone, again, who's interested in political journalism, and I'm sure this would be true of like someone like Robinson or whoever, or Andrew Neil, it's sort of, there is obviously a sort of lure of it. And there's always that question of, You can talk to as many people as you like and you think you can have an understanding, but you never truly know what it's like to be in the room, right? You never truly know the dynamics of it. Journalists are always, however insidery they are, and I wouldn't say I was a particularly insidery one, but however insidery they are, they're always on the outside. So yeah, of course there is that. But I think that there is, the thing is that ultimately I wanted to go into journalism partly because I think, as you say, there is, if you're political, then you have a quite strong sense of what is right and wrong and how the world could be better. And I think in my career, as well as being able to kind of be where the story is, which I do find sort of personally thrilling, there have been moments that I can point to, whether it's the kind of like stuff around the exams crisis or sort of leasehold stuff, or, you know, when I was at Sky, and there was and stories there where I can sort of look back and say, I think I made a bit of a difference to that without sounding too grand about it. Partly because the fusion between politics and the media is now so sort of great. And, you know, one of the things, in some ways, social media has probably debilitated me in some ways in terms of my career. But in other ways, it allows you to be able, a great joy, which is to be able to sort of point at something and say, we should all be looking at that. We should all be looking at that. And the power to do that, and to sort of shape the conversation a bit, is, if you have a bit of a profile, is actually quite great. So it has its compensations as well as being a kind of thrilling career. I think the other thing for me in politics, if I ever did think about it, is I'm a bit of a I'm not sure how much of a, partly because being a journalist, I'm not sure I'm that much of a team player. You know, in politics, you have to be a real team player. You know, you're not just yourself. Like, I always get annoyed when people say things like, oh, why doesn't XMP just, say what they think. It's like, no, like when you're a Labour MP or you're a Conservative MP, or even more so if you're a minister, you're not there because of what you think, right? You're there because you're part of the whole. And so being party discipline is really, really important. I'm so down on like the general kind of like tendency within politics and media to sort of be down on parties. I think it's so sort of hollow and two-dimensional. But that's really important. I'm not sure if I could do that. I don't know, partly because I've got so used to being my own person. Do you know what I mean? And like, it doesn't really matter. I can sort of say what I like and it doesn't really matter. Although at the BBC, you can't really do that as much. But, you know, being a journalist, you're very much yourself. It's one of the reasons journalists make terrible managers, is because you're sort of yourself, right? And I don't know if I could adapt to being part of the whole. I don't know.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs.
Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You mentioned earlier about some political journalists saying things that are very bland. And I just wonder, sometimes I listen to people, I think, not only do I think you don't actually understand what makes politicians tick, I actually don't think you understand the public either. I don't think you'll look... I mean, I think of the conversation around Keir Starmer at the moment, and I think so much of the commentary around him is basically nonsense. And I think you're not understanding why people are going to vote at the next election. And so much of the noise that some people get obsessed with, it's just almost like for their own entertainment. I actually don't think they understand what motivates people to vote at all. I mean, I don't know. It sounds like that's a frustration that you share at times.
I find just so much of the kind of Westminster conversation just so unreal. Like, and I an example of that. So, you know, a couple of weeks ago when Sunak was talking about deferring the point at which the ban on petrol and diesel cars would come in, right, until 2035. And I could not believe, and again, this is one of the great joys of being able to kind of speak for yourself a bit, I just couldn't, I couldn't believe that we basically went 24 hours and almost no one, with only a couple of exceptions, it went through the whole Westminster narrative machine and it went through the papers, and it's much easier for a Tory PM to determine this stuff, dictate this stuff, because they've got the papers on their side. But, you know, and literally the way it was being covered, even by, you know, some in broadcast, you know, you'd think that this was, as Sunak was sort of presenting it, this sort of great coup for sort of hard-strapped press families across the country. I'm like, excuse me, I mean, how many poor people or even middle-off people or even quite rich people do you know buy a new car? Almost no one. Like literally almost no one. And like, you wouldn't have known it from virtually any of the coverage. And yet Sunak was able to basically present it as a kind of great coup de grace for a sort of motorists across the country everywhere. And that's just a small example of just how untethered and unmoored from reality so much of the SW1 conversation is. Some of that is purely for political reasons, because they want it to be unmoored, because they're presenting a certain way of looking at it, and the sort of papers are sort of complicit in that. Some of it is just because genuinely these people, and this is what always makes me laugh and does my head in slightly, like, you know, these people who present themselves as some great tribune of like how ordinary people think, honestly, they wouldn't know an ordinary person if they came and slapped them in the face. I mean, they really wouldn't, let alone how they live. And too much of SW1 is like that.
Do you think that's partly the success of the news agents then, is actually that there is a huge market for the sort of thing that you three are doing, that people want political coverage that they can identify with more, that it's resonating with people more than perhaps some of the other places?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, look, I think, you know, obviously we've been surprised by the extent to which it's done so well. Like, if you take the sort of 24-hour download periods now, it's basically kind of getting the same sort of numbers that like a TV, you know, sort of Newsnight would get or whatever, which in the space of a year is sort of astonished us. And it's astonished me. I mean, to be honest, I thought it would be, if I'm totally honest, I didn't think it would be a side project, but I thought it would be something that wouldn't take up that much of my time. I thought, honestly, like podcasting, how hard can that be, right? You just go in and just talk for 40 minutes and whatever. And of course, as a podcast doyen yourself, you know, there's so much more to it than that. But I sort of naively thought that. And actually, it turns out it's quite a bit more than that, because it's basically a kind of whole brand. But I think that there is a market for a news which is not polemic. It's not just shouting off about what you think the whole time, but nor is it as completely constrained by the kind of norms and rules of traditional broadcasting, which, although I still basically support in lots of ways, I do think sometimes can stultify the way that kind of just the way it sounds. Like, one of the things that it's like, it's same in politics right now, for good or ill, all people want is authenticity. They want the sense, audiences and voters are very sophisticated now, right? They kind of see through a lot of the artifice of established kind of norms, like kind of or institutions like TV or politics, and they just want that sense of sort of realness, reality. And I think that kind of being able to just sometimes sort of step away from that a little bit and be quite direct about when you're reporting something kind of resonates with people. And I think that's part of it.
And how do you feel about shows like Newsnight now?
Well, I'm a huge advocate for it, and I'm very much against, who knows, but maybe by the time people are listening to this, there will have been a decision on it, but I'm very, very much against, obviously, the BBC, any suggestion that they cut it or make it into a kind of husk. I think, you know, the truth is about Newsnight, really, is that they've deprived it of resources for a very long time. And also, they took the legs away under it, to be honest. I mean, like, when I was there, and particularly after the kind of Emily famous, well, they call it a monologue, but it wasn't. It was just a cue into Dominic Cummings, into a piece of mine, actually, about him and Barnard Castle. They basically made it very clear after that that a script that was being that was going to go out on Newsnight was basically going to be treated the same way as a script for the 10 o'clock news. Now, that was just never going to, in terms of the language and potential of around complaints. And that was just never going to work, because the whole point of Newsnight is you've already got the 10 o'clock news. You don't just need a slightly flabbier 10 o'clock news. You don't need just a kind of slightly stodgier 10 o'clock news. It's a news and current affairs show. So it can lean into the current affairs element of the remit. It can have a little bit more personality, a bit more punch, have a bit more jeopardy, be a bit more unexpected. And they basically, and they still do that, because I've got amazing sort of colleagues there, ex-colleagues there, and they still try and do that. But it's become a lot harder for them to do that. It was harder when I was there as well. And if in that case, it just slightly takes the legs from under it. But it's still a great program, and it's absolutely. And if you didn't have Newsnight, the truth is, it would be necessary in that Voltairean way to invent it. Because you need a place where you have quality filmmaking and you have interviews that are sort of agenda setting and at the end of the day. So in some form, I guarantee they can take it away and they'll just recreate it in some way.
So when you leave, you, Emily and John, how did that work? Were you approached as a trio from the outset, or was one person approached and then they spoke to the other person or the other person?
No, they had announced, John and Emily had, gone on holiday for like 3 months at the start of 2022, because she was working on her screenplay for her Prince Andrew drama. So she was gone. She was gone for 3 months. And then in the middle of that, in February, she announced, totally to all of our surprise, that she was leaving to do the show. I was like, what the bloody, was she going to do a podcast? Like a daily pop? What? Why? You know, why is she doing that? She's leaving Newsnight to go and do some daily podcast at Global. We were like, I was completely confused by it. And then I decided to go and do it with them. But a few months later, they sort of approached me and said that they wanted to have a third person on it. And would I think about it? And I sort of thought about it. We had a long conversation, and then they announced that I was going to do it as well. So it was I sort of came afterwards. But I think, you know, Emily had been thinking about her future, and I think John had as well, because although John, I think, you know, could well have ended up political editor if he hadn't done this, but he decided he wanted to do this. So it was a sort of gradual thing. And then we started last September.
I can't believe you're only 34. Do you think, I've achieved so much, at such an age?
No, I don't think I've achieved very much at all. Like,
published author. Podcaster, broadcaster.
I was a working class lad. I don't like this sort of compliments. You know how it is. I just throw an insult at me, will you? Honestly,
It's hard. You're a good looking fella. No, you're not a waste of space. You're articulate. You're good looking. You're bright.
Oh God, I need my dad here to tell me that I'm a plank or something.
So what? Because you mentioned being from Birmingham.
Yeah.
But you don't have like a West Midlands accent. So was that?
No.
What's going on there?
I'm quite ashamed of that. I do when I've had a drink. And again, when I'm angry. My wife says, who's Norwegian, but she can recognise enough Brummies, so occasionally if I've had if I'm angry or if I've had a drink. Well, that's making me sound like I'm abusive or something. I'm not.
how do you sound when you've had a drink then?
Oh, well, a bit like that. You know what I mean, Matt? Yeah.
So did you used
Come
to
on,
sound
put
like
it in
that?
There. Put it in there. Go on.
All right, Bab.
All right, Bab. Go on. Give me another pint of mild there. That's it. Fantastic. No, there's a few words. Yeah, I'm a bit ashamed of that, really. I don't know why. I think that it happened. I didn't have like a massively strong Birmingham accent anyway. My dad's from Middlesbrough. I remember he used to have a bit more of a sort of weird, like, Brummy, northerny sort of twang. But and then I went to Oxford, and I think I think at Oxford, I think it disappeared. And not consciously. I think that it was, I think people underestimate, I think it's a bit different now, but particularly then, it's so Southern, Oxford. So Southern. Like, crazily so. And this is the only time in my life, and you won't believe this, but I remember going there, and I had a great time at Oxford, but it is a very weird place. And like, I had, it's Blair's fault, really. I mean, it's Labour's fault, because I did this summer school when I was at school, and you spent a week in Oxford, right? And it was for kids, it's called Aim Higher, and it was for state school kids who had never, you know, their schools had very little history of sending kids to university, let alone higher, you know, the top university. And I went for a week, and it was obviously full of other kids like me. So it was a total illusion, right? It was a complete fan. I thought, this is great. It's amazing. And so I applied and went. I'm sure I wouldn't have done so if it weren't for that. But then obviously when I got there, it was completely different, because actually the reality was, right, there were more kids from Eton in my, you know, year than there were, you know, certainly from almost any, well, certainly probably from state schools in Birmingham, probably if you exclude the grammar schools, to be honest. And I remember one lovely girl, and she was so posh. I mean, honestly, she was so posh. She was so posh, you know, they barely move their mouths, you know, is that kind of taught somehow that it's wrong to sort of move your mouth in any kind of way. And she said, oh, Lewis, we love having you here. You know, you're the college's bit of rough.
It's oh, God.
Only time in my life I've ever been called a bit of rough.
Were you intimidated by that?
No, I wasn't intimidated by it. I wasn't intimidated by it at all. I think I probably did what I naturally do in those circumstances, which is I sort of like overcompensate by being more confident and more kind of, I wasn't intimidated, but it was certainly the first time in my life that I realized that I actually kind of saw class up close. I had never even met anyone from private school, I don't think, up to that point. I don't think I'd ever met anyone. And it was the first time that I think, you know, again, it's Blair's fault, because I genuinely think when I was at school, and you remember this, you know, not being at school at the time, but, you know, around that time, I genuinely think that I had bought the idea that the kind of New Labour was almost like the end of history. It was like class and things like that is something that even though it's kind of ridiculous, because I was in this school that in many ways was not, it did its best, but it wasn't a great school in some ways. And, you know, class was all around, you know, you could see it. But I genuinely thought that all that had gone because Blair was there. Because New Labour was there, you know, that was all in the past. And I was lucky to be born when I was. And in a way, I think looking back, I really was very lucky, but for different reasons. And then I went to Oxford and I was like, oh, Christ, right, okay. There are all these people and they've got like loads of money. And they're not just loads of money, but they're so urbane and kind of sophisticated and kind of and sort of cool in a way, you know, all this sort of thing. And it was the first time in my life, I genuinely think I thought it was a naive thing, because I think being quite clever and working class in the sort of New Labour period, you were quite lucky because there's quite a lot thrown at you. And I think it was hugely to my benefit. And it was the first time in my life I realised, and it did shape me slightly. I was like, oh, right, life isn't going to be one big linear kind of ascent. It's going to like have ups and downs, and it's going to be like, and there's going to be obstacles, and there are going to be other people there who are going to be in your way. Do you know what I mean? And like my mum, God bless her, who's not always the wisest lady, but she was very wise on this. I remember her saying just before, you know, Lewis, you're going to meet very different sort of people and it's going to be difficult for you. I said, oh, what do you mean? So it's going to be difficult, because you're always used to being this sort of big fish in your, you know, little world, and you're not going to be anymore. I said, oh, shut up, of course I am. And of course,
you're quite a brat kid then, it sounds. It sounds like you're actually a terrible boy. Rooty and mother?
No, I wasn't a brat. It's just because my mum was so young, you know. She was like, she was only 17 when she had me, right? So I just, that was the sort of relationship that we had and have. But yeah, but I would always, yeah, probably assume she was wrong. Probably still do, God knows.
But what a strong character you've got to respond to that environment with confidence rather than be intimidated by it. Where does that come from?
No, I don't know, really. I don't know. I don't know. But it probably wasn't strength in a way, was it? It was probably weakness in a way. It was probably actual nervousness. It was probably like actually, and I did have a bit of a kind of, I did have a bit of a crisis at Oxford in a sense, but it was a very inward one. It wasn't like no one would have known on the outside, but it was that sense of just a bit like, oh, Christ, you know, this is hard. I think I also kind of thought, to be honest, again, it's that naivety, right? I think when I got into Oxford, and I was so happy. Like I basically worked, I'd sort of thrown everything at it. I basically thought, if I do this, then that's it. I'm going to be set. That's it. I don't basically don't have to work anymore. That's it. I'm going to be in the inner sanctum, right? I'm going to have entered the sort of the British inner sanctum, right? And that's it. And then I got there and I was like, oh, God, it's not like that at all. So I think all of my assumptions about the world and my own kind of progress within them sort of wobble. But yeah, I don't know where it comes from, really. I think I just, but the main reason I'm actually glad that I went to Oxford now, when I look back, it's not because it opened up things necessarily. It's more because I'm really glad it gave me actually was a kind of a sort of intellectual self-confidence. I think if I hadn't got in, I worry I would have been, I mean, some people say I've got a chip on my shoulder now, but I think I would always have had this sense that I didn't get in, and that would have been, and I would have met people later on, and it would have been there on my shoulder, just constantly whispering in my ear. But I think that the sort of intel, it gives you a sort of just sense of like, when you're meeting some of these pricks who actually know nothing and are actually not very, you know, not particularly intelligent at all, but it's just been sort of handed to them, it just gives you a sort of sense of, no, I can deal with this. You know, I can deal with this. It's absolutely fine. I think that's basically whatever you actually learn there, to me, I actually think it just allowed me to sort of be calm on that score and have a kind of self-belief.
Your mum must be so proud of you.
My mum, yeah, she is very proud. Yeah, she is, I think. Yeah, she is. She definitely is. Yeah, she is. She is. I'm very proud of her. I mean, she's always had her ups and downs, God love her, but she's a strong lady. Yeah, she's a strong lady. I do. And when I look back now, I kind of, and what's scary now is that when my mum was my age now, I was 17. I was about to go to Oxford.
Man.
Which is absolutely nuts. There's a very real chance she could outlive me. I mean, I could die when I'm 80 and she could be 97. I mean, it's absolutely totally incredible. And when I was born, she, it's all nuts stuff. We were in the Birmingham Mail when I was born, right? Because we were five generations. So I knew my nan's nan very quite well. My Nana Jill, which is actually
incredible.
Nuts. And I tell people that and they think that I was like I was born in like basically Peaky Blinders or something. Like I was born in like, when Stanley Baldwin was prime minister or whatever.
How fitting that even your birth was in the news from literally the moment you popped out. News was fused with who Lewis Goodall is.
I don't know how that got in. Yeah, that's weird. I never thought about that. Yeah. That's funny. But yeah, she, I do think, yeah, I think when she talks about being a teenage mum in the late 80s and early 90s, actually what that was like, she actually like, I think much more so than it would be now. I mean, you know, she always tells this story when she used to go into the, like go in for her sort of checkups, like when she was pregnant. She said that they always made a point of saying, oh, would Sandra come into the waiting room, or would Claire come into the waiting room? She always made a point of going, would Miss Paige, please come in.
Bastards.
It's all, I mean, I know, bastards. Although she was, as she would say herself now, I think she did, go down the social and give a few untruths about the current home situation, about my dad not being there. But it doesn't matter. It's
got to do
now.
What you got to do. Had she not done that, God knows what would have happened to you, Lewis. Had she not done everything in her power to give you the very best upbringing possible, we would have been deprived. The news agents would just be John and Emily.
Oh, God.
Imagine that.
Who would imagine that? Imagine that. God, what would that be like? Oh, they'd just be muttering at each other the whole time. No Lewis. One would be there to.
This has been such a treat. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and it has flown by. No. Enjoy the rest of your week in Liverpool. And I would love to interview you a live show one day.
I would love that. I would love that. Absolutely. Bring my mum along. Bring Carmen along.
That would be absolutely phenomenal. Cheers, mate.
My pleasure. Speak soon.
Well, there you go. Lewis Goodall, whose hotel Wi-Fi just about held out in order for us to record that. And as always, you're just like, man, I need hours with him. Do you know what I mean? I almost want to just meet up with him for a few pints and just record the whole thing. He's just a great person to talk to. And has that great mix of the fire in the belly and the clarity of thought and the talent of broadcasting and thinking. And you can see why he's such a big part of the news agents and its success. Because he's so good at breaking things down and communicating them. And there's also just a genuine love of it. And I think that really comes across. And obviously, that's something I really identify with. Hopefully you are enjoying conference season. This feed is now back up and running after a temporary blip. But as I said at the start, there won't be any live shows for a few weeks. And then as soon as I can, they'll be put back in and we'll be back at the Duchess Theatre and all the rest of it. But I'm going to record a few of these before I go into hospital, and then that will keep you ticking over. And obviously, you're at liberty to peruse the back catalogue, but certainly my intention is to curate a little series of some of the best ones. But I shall shut up now. The usual stuff. Oh, I've put a link to Lewis's book so you can buy it. But the usual stuff. Please leave a 5-star written review. And I'll see you soon. Ta-ra.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.